I need you to knock some sense into me. I'm sure you can.
Yeah, I don't know.
I enjoy listening to you. I don't always agree with everything.
All right. Enough of this persiflage.
So, you want my question?
I'm certainly not going to get myself in trouble by telling you what to do.
That makes great sense. Gosh, that's good.
Did I overwhelm you with words and wisdom?
I've got 7 kids. I feel like I could call you every day.
Wait, you're telling me I'm wrong? Disconnect.
Yes, I am, Dr. Ray.
You just need to tune in to Dr. Ray, honey. He's got all the answers.
Am I right or am I right?
Probably.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
You know what I noticed? I've noticed that most people want to live a long life. But the idea of getting old doesn't appeal to most anybody. Living a long life appeals to everybody. Idea of getting old doesn't appeal to anybody. We humans, we're interesting people. Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In. This is a variant of The Doctor Is In. We used to say version, but now I have to say variant. Trying to keep up with the times. E-Person Monday. Had to find a way to answer the ones that I could. I answer all of them in some way. I either ask to call the show, or a lot of times they're asking for a particular referral, or they're interested in which of my books answers what for them. Sometimes they are for speaking engagements, but I would say maybe 40% of them, maybe half, are particular situations. And those are the ones, every once in a while I will call the person, because my heart breaks given the situation they're in. See what I can do to offer a nudge in one direction or another. But for the most part, I will put those aside to be used on E-Person Monday. That's how we'll do it. I've said before that I don't remember the particulars of the email. I still say email sometimes because I slip. But when I read it, I try to analyze it like someone's talking to me. And I'll comment in between the sentences, two or three sentences, those kinds of things. And I oftentimes don't know exactly how it ends. Don't know what the person is asking or what situation's unfolding toward the end. And I like it if I can anticipate it. Sometimes I miss it. But I'd like it if, in fact, I can anticipate it. So, now I've noticed I'm having a little trouble here. I don't know why my phone is doing this. It is not downloading anything. Now, fortunately, I have some. Oh, boy. I've got some that are printed out. I've printed them out. All right. So, let me see what I can find. Well, I'll find those during the break. Okay. Older theories of pain said that pain was pretty much a linear function. What does that mean? It's related directly in a linear way to the amount of tissue destruction, or the amount of disorder, or the amount of microbial attack on the body. The more destruction, the more particular disorder, the more breakdown in the functioning of places in the body, the more pain. Linear. As many have studied pain, and boy, oh boy, it's been studied up one side and down the other, painful how much they've gotten into it, they found that there is a huge component of perception involved in pain. Now, you talk about perception in terms of reading people's motives, how you interpret what they've said, the perception of circumstances, all of these things psychology's on top of, saying, yeah, perception's big. Matter of fact, a lot of therapy is involving altering people's perceptions closer to reality. I have a perception that because I got fired, that automatically means I'm a failure. Now, it might mean you acted poorly on your job, but it might not mean that at all. There might be other considerations there. And if your perception is, I was fired because I'm a loser, well, that's a perception that's going to cause you a lot of problems. People understand that perception in the matters of psychology or social relations or life circumstances is a potent force. They give less attention to perception when there's pain. Let me draw an example here. Let's say you've had a very mysterious headache, and it seems to have come upon you rather suddenly. Okay, you've taken some over-the-counter pain relievers, and it helped a little, dulled it a little bit, took the edge off somewhat, but as soon as you stop the pain reliever, as soon as they got through their 4 hours or 8 hours or 12 hours, the headache came back. And it's been nagging. It's ooh, you've never had anything like this, and sometimes it really hurts. It's right there above your eyes. And so what do? Well, you head for the internet. That's right. Dive into the internet. And you read. And they give you a list of potential causes for your kind of headache. And some of these causes are scary. They speak of some serious stuff. Brain involvement, or possible tumors, or even cancer. Fluid buildup. It's, oh, gee. Now, here's the question. As you read the list, and as you saw potentially the reasons for this now month-old headache that has not really left you alone, would your pain seem worse, the same, or better? For most people, it would be worse. Why? Because you're not sure what it means now, and you've looked at what it could mean, and it's scary stuff. So your perception of the pain, this ongoing, unrelenting headache, could indicate some deeper pathology. Oh boy, oh boy. So when you wake up in the morning, or as the day progresses and your headache comes on stronger and stronger, you're thinking, what is going on here? I sure hope it isn't some of the stuff I read about. And your perception of the pain is now worse. The pain seems much worse. In fact, the actual pain itself has not changed. Pain's the same. Your perception of it has made it much, much, much worse. Well, you relent. You head to the doc. Doc does some testing, some other stuff. And he says, I can't find anything. I can't find anything. Have you looked into perhaps some eye strain? You're thinking to yourself, eye strain? Eye strain can cause that? I don't think so. But nevertheless, you make an appointment with your ophthalmologist. And you find out, absolutely, oh boy, you have been unconsciously straining like crazy when you read. You didn't realize it. You're trying to compensate for it. You need glasses. And now you find this out, and they say, pick up the prescription day after tomorrow. Here's the question. Would the experience of the pain now seem worse, the same, or less? I I believe it would seem less. Why? Because you know what it is. And it's not as threatening. Matter of fact, it's not threatening at all, unless you're vain and you don't want to wear glasses, so maybe in that case you get soft contacts. But all the things that you thought perhaps this 1 month long headache could indicate are not causes. That happens a lot with anxiety. When people have a panic attack, their perception of the anxiety really makes the anxiety seem a lot worse. Because they're scared of it. What's going on? Am I having a heart attack? Am I going to die? Am I going to throw up? Am I going to look like a crazy person? This is awful. I've never had a feeling like that. I feel like everything's going to be doom. But if you knew that it was a very anxious arousal from your system, doesn't make it pleasant, just like a headache isn't pleasant, but it makes it less threatening. It makes it less likely to frighten the bejeebers out of you because you don't know what it is. The perception of pain, the perception of anxiety, how you read it, how you interpret it, can make it seem better or worse. All right, I'll be back.
You're awesome. I love listening to you. And I even got my husband listening to you, and we're both in our 70s.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
The doctor is in Ann Arbor. Don't miss this chance to join Dr. Ray's studio audience for tapings of his hit TV show, Living Right with Dr. Ray.
The live audience makes the show.
The tapings are October 28th and 29th. Two shows each night at 5:30 and 7:15 p.m. All shows are at Russell Video in Ann Arbor, and the cost is free.
Without the audience, there is no show.
Just sign up at AveMariaRadio.net.
Very much would love to see you.
Hello, Steve Ray here from Footprints of God Pilgrimages. The land of our Lord and our Lady is calling us. We're heading back to the Holy Land over Christmas break this year. We have the best, most reliable guides and services awaiting us. The holy sites are open, and the local Christians are anxious to see us. Galilee, Jerusalem, Nazareth, Bethlehem. No crowds, no lines. Hope you can join us.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Very nice to have you with me, Dr. Ray Guarendi here, program Doctors In, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time, co-production of Ave Maria Radio Communication and the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. This is E-Person Monday, so let's get to the persons of the ease. Hope I can answer them with ease. Hello, Dr. Ray. Thank you for taking time to read my email. My mother was wanting some advice from me. Well, wait a minute. If she's asking it for you, then okay, you do it, not me. on how to go about telling someone that they complain much. All right, stop right there. Usually when someone says telling someone, they put it generically. All right, how do you tell someone, i.e. nameless, faceless person, they complain much? But almost always it's a personal situation. It is someone in the center of their lives that they're asking this about, but the initial question is phrased generically. Then she says, that someone happens to be my sister. Yeah, typically you don't get the admission that quick. My mom is concerned about the complaining making my sister and her husband unhappy, it being a generally unhealthy practice. My most recently published book was titled How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. In one of the chapters, I talked about three conversation killers that in the short term will sabotage a conversation. But if they're patterns, if they're a style, they'll sabotage a relationship. And complaining was one of them. Definitely complaining was one of them. When you love somebody and they're telling you about their troubles or their pains or their circumstances, you want to help, you want to be empathic. But we all have our limits. We all got a belly reservoir of hearing complaining. Like the old country song says, you can feel bad if it makes you feel better. And we'll listen to complaining more if the person is seeking a solution. If you can offer advice and feel helpful, and they seem to take it in and want to do something with it. But if it's complaining for complaining's sake, let me just tell you how life is treating me. Let me tell you how bad it is. Let me tell you why I'm so unhappy. Let me tell you what happened to me that's so unfair. If that becomes a relentless style, you could be the most wonderful, charitable person in the world, but I'll tell you what, you're going to retreat from that person. Or you're going to retreat from contacts. You'll limit the contact. My sister mostly complains about her very young children. Let me stop right there. It came to my attention recently that somebody that I know has a friend who is extremely upset at her three-year-old. Her attitude is, she is just so bad. She's so bad. I don't like being around her. Now, when you got a three-year-old that is pushing on you, acting up, that's a three-year-old. The parent is the one that needs to take a hard, hard look at themselves and not the kid. But this woman is absolutely convinced. She even sent the kid somewhere so she could get away from her. Instead of looking at herself and saying, hey, she ain't bad, she's just doing pushy stuff that three-year-olds do if I let her. And if she's a bit of a pushy kid. So she mostly complains about her very young children. Now, I don't know if the sister is willing to take any advice on how to take... Mostly when people complain about very young kids, it's discipline stuff. It's truly discipline stuff. And she complains about her aches and pains and other things. I told my mom, I have no idea about this. My sister, while a very sweet and loving lady, can be sensitive and insecure. Well, the two probably go together with complaining, I would think. I told my mom I would ask Dr. Ray. You did you? Any advice on how to correct gently a sensitive and insecure person without hurting their feelings? Well, see, now you threw in that last clause, without hurling their feelings. There's all kinds of ways to gently correct. You could say, does making you complain about this help you to feel any better? Or are you saying that you want to solve some of this? Are you asking for my advice? Those are all ways. Now, if you're going to throw in that qualifier without hurting their feelings, I have no idea. I have no idea how they're going to interpret it. I don't know the person. But I think that's about as safe as you can with somebody who complains. Because when they're complaining, they're telling you about a problem that's driving them crazy. And you just ask them, are you asking for my advice on this? Or, what have you tried to solve this problem? Or, so, what are you saying you want to do about this? Keep pointing it back to, are you looking for a solution? I don't know if that would hurt their feelings. There's certainly no intent here to hurt anybody's feelings. But let's just say you do something like that. And in fact, they don't react well to it. Take that as a cue. If it didn't work this time, probably ain't going to work next time. And you have to decide at what point you will essentially quit listening to the complaining. Whether it's on the phone, whether it's a visit. What will you do, perhaps subtly? Well, I got to get going, okay? I got something I got to take care of. Or if they're in a family gathering and they got you cornered, and you get up and you say, I'm going to go get myself something to drink, or I got to go to the bathroom, whatever you got to do, you break off the conversation, because you don't just sit there and have somebody drone on and on. That doesn't help them at all. Actually, in a subtle sort of way, it rewards them. And it's one thing to listen and be empathic and understanding, but when this becomes a relentless conversational style, which is I just have to keep rehearsing how things are not going the way I want them to go, with no look toward finding a solution, then you're not helping them. You're not helping them at all. It's not charitable to sit there and just absorb it. What does that do? Just keep redirecting. Are you asking for a solution? Are you asking for discipline help with your four-year-old? Is that what you're saying? In other words, you don't just endlessly nod and go, oh my, oh gosh. Ooh, that's rough. That's rough. Have you talked to a doctor about that tendonitis in your shoulder? What's the doctor say? Are there over-the-counter prescriptions, or over-the-counter meds you can take on this? In other words, you keep redirecting the conversation back toward solution. What is the solution? Chronic complaining pushes people away. And I've noticed as I've gotten older, and more of the people that I hang around with are older, it is easy to dwell upon what is going wrong in your abilities, in your body, in your social circle. Not 28 anymore. Stuff hurts. But it's easy to talk about all the stuff hurts, to go into an organ recital with others. Don't do it.
Take
for joining me, Dr. Ray Grandy. Program Doctors In, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. This is the Monday variant of the Doctors In E-Person Monday. I have rarely had this opening appellation on an E-Person. Good evening, Dr. Ray. Well, apparently this was written in the evening, and not an assumption that that's when I'm reading it. My wife and I have 5 children, 6 months to 8 years. It feels as if we are at an extremely difficult season of life. Well, in our culture, if you tell people you have 5 children from 6 months to age 8 and you are in a difficult season of life, they will look at you like, well, what do you expect? What were you thinking? They will. They won't empathize unless there's someone who thinks like you do, which is fewer and farther between in life. I work shift work with a good amount of overtime. All right, what he's saying is I'm not there as much. Our 3-year-old son has by far been our most testing child and at times makes us feel extremely overwhelmed and distraught. Okay, I'm going to argue with you. I don't doubt that this is your toughest kid. You're going to have 5 kids. Somebody's got to be the toughest. Somebody's got to be the easiest. The toughest could be toughest. All right. That's the first thing. In today's parenting, usually when somebody describes their kid as the most testing, toughest kid, the most challenging, the most defiant, oppositional kid of their kids, they don't stop there. Unspoken, or sometimes spoken, is what's wrong? Something's got to be wrong. What is with this kid? Maybe he's got some loose connectors up in his brain, as one mother put it to me. She said, yeah, maybe there's just loose connectors up there. The second thing I'm going to say is 3-year-olds can only be so tough. They can be bratty, or they can throw fits, or they can melt down, but they can't do the stuff that a 12-year-old can do, or a 16-year-old. Come on, they don't have the control, the savvy, the brain, the shiftiness, the savviness. They just don't have it. They can be defiant. That's it. That's about it. Straightforward defiance. So the question becomes, in those defiant episodes, which it sounds like is more than the other kids, what are you going to do? If you say to yourself, well, we deal with it. Okay, good. But it doesn't make any difference. Well, yes and no. Most of the time, I've found that when you have a tough kid, the parents underestimate the kind of consistency they have to have. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, sometimes the change may be slow. He's only 3. We've tried everything. No, you haven't. He's only 3. How could you have tried everything? So, just a couple of thoughts there. Now, that said, we try to be more stubborn than he is, but we are clearly not winning. Oh, of course you are. You control everything. Are you telling me that you can't get this kid to sit on the steps when he does something wrong? Or to go stand in the corner? Is that what you're saying? Because if you can't do that, then yes, I can see how you'd be overwhelmed. I had 10 kids. I had 10 kids with some of them very difficult histories. My kids are adopted. Bad histories. Bad womb environments. Which made them bouncy to be socialized. My wife made sure that she is going to make it stick. If I tell you to sit on the couch or go lay on your bed or put your head down at the table, that's going to happen. That is going to happen, or I'll shut down every privilege you got. So that's the first thing you got to do. You tell that 3-year-old when he does something wrong or defies or whatever it is, that in fact, now I just got a call from Teresa Tomio here, and I had to decline it. But she also took away my e-person on my phone, and until she hangs up, she's going to, okay, hold on a second. How do I get rid of this? All right, did that. Okay. So that's the first thing. Between his getting into things, yelling, hitting walls, unbuckling his car seat, we're a loss. And this doesn't even include trying to attend to the needs of our other four. Now, he's the dust kicker-upper. He's the one who, in fact. But keeping in mind that he does this stuff. Now, I don't know your situation, and I really don't know what the dynamic is regarding your discipline, but I will tell you this. When a parent comes to my office with a three-year-old that is totally buffaloing them, nine times out of ten, the parent thinks they're being consistent and following through and being clear in their authority, and they're partway there. And they're not there enough for the kids' sake. They were there enough for the other kids. They responded. Not this one. This one pushes. About 4 years ago, I felt God place on my heart the need to be open to a large family. At that time, I was not as open. Sometimes I feel so foolish thinking I'm being open to God's will, but seems to be so out of control within our family life. We attend church every Sunday with the whole family. We try diligently to say prayers at meals and before bed. I've even backed off overtime at work to be home more. Dr. A, advice please. Certainly, sir. Good news, bad news. Get a bunch of kids, chances are you're going to get a tough one. But that doesn't mean he's going to be tough when he's 15. I've heard priests talk about them being the toughest kid of their family. And they're priests now. Good priests. So that doesn't mean that. And as a matter of fact, my toughest child in terms of just discipline, my son Pete, he was by far the most challenging 3-, 4-, 5-year-old. By far! He's 28. He's the most loving, caring, loving his faith and the church. But when he was 3, 4, 5, we had to break the will of that boy. Real quick story. We were at a petting zoo, and he was there with his brother James. James was 1 year older. And this little ostrich came over and scared James. And James just crumbled and started crying. He came over to Pete. I think Pete kicked the ostrich about 6 times. He was only 3 or 4. Not intimidated at all. We had to pull Pete off the ostrich, lest he hurt the ostrich. So, what I would say to you is this. I'm going to help you here. You need to really assess your discipline skills. I know I'd love to give you advice. We're not doing therapy here. Love to give you advice on this. But I do have a book for you. It's called Discipline That Lasts a Lifetime. 100 of the most common discipline questions I get asked. It's on my website. It really will put you back in authority, and it'll help you look at the things you could do differently so that this 3-year-old doesn't suck off all your energy and make you feel like a totally inept failure at parenthood. And who knows, maybe you'll have another child or two. So much for joining me here, Dr. Ray Guarendi program. Doctor's in. E-Person Monday is today. Mostly tackling. Forgive the semi-violent language. Tackling. Okay. Mostly addressing your e-persons that come in from various angles. Let me see if I can get this one. The phone is giving me trouble here. Keep saying not downloading. I don't know why it's not downloading. I don't get that at all. All right, let me scroll down to... Okay, I'll try this one more time, and then I'll just jump to the next one. Try that. There it is. This message has not been downloaded from the server. I don't understand that because it was downloaded before when I looked at it. All right, let's go here. This is a classic example of my total incompetence. That one's not download. Let's see what this one says. Your manalog today, and they're referring to a previous program a while back, was just the one I needed to hear. I'm working on focusing on my gratitude and decreasing my anxiety. I am ashamed that I should be anxious at all when we have so much more than others, but that's how it usually works, doesn't it? I could have called in because I have several things I'd like to ask you. I wish I could disguise my voice, but my Chicago accent is never going away. I remember that monologue. It was this. And again, I got to qualify this because living expenses, standard of living, is wildly divergent across the cultures and the countries of the world. However, assuming some uniformity, especially in the Western world, if I remember the statistics, do I have that with me? No, I left it somewhere else. Okay. If you have combined assets of $500,000, now many of you listening do, because you own your home. And right now, the average home in the U.S. is worth about $480,000. It's the cost of a home in the U.S. You got a West Coast or the East Coast. You know, you live in a normal, what would have been a middle-class home 40, 50 years ago is now $1 million, $1.5 million. So if your assets, combined assets, retirement accounts, cars, house, whatever it is $500,000, half a million. You are in the top 1% monetarily of the world. Your wealth puts you in the top 1%. Now, you may look around you and say, yeah, but, you know, that neighborhood down the street, those houses are huge, man. I don't have a house like that. Well, you got to watch who you're comparing yourself to. We tend to do this. We tend to compare ourselves to those closest around us. And that makes it like, well, I don't have that. I can't afford that kind of car. Yeah, but you could have been born anywhere else in this world, and you are where you are. And if you got $500,000, and I know most of you listening to me do, you're in the top 1%. Let's drop it. Let's drop it to 100,000. Now, I'm virtually positive almost everybody listening to me, unless you're 9 years old, has assets totaling $100,000. I mean, you got two cars, and they're both relatively new. They're worth about $20,000-$30,000 a piece. You're already halfway there. You are in the top 8%. 92% of the world does not have $100,000. But Dr. Egg, wait a minute. You know, some of those cultures, $100,000 makes you wealthy, wealthy. That's true. That is true. But let's just look at this as uniformly as we can in terms of perhaps Europe, U.S., Canada, Australia, Japan, some of these places. Drop it down. Go down to 50. $50,000. You have assets totaling $50,000. 87th percentile. In other words, you're in the top 13%. $50,000. Much of the world doesn't own anything. They subsist. They get by day to day. Even though the world is nowhere near as poverty stricken as it was 50 years ago, there's still a lot of people who just eke out day to day their living. All right, let's drop it further. $10,000. Your total assets are $10,000. The average 16-year-old probably has that. You're in the top, well, you're above 68th percentile. In other words, 68% of the world measured has less than $10,000. $4,210. What an odd number. Why would you pick that number, because that is the dividing line. That is the 50th percentile. Half the world has possessions totaling less than that. Half the world has possessions totaling more than that. Maybe the majority of American kids, ages 18, 19, 20, and above, have assets. I mean, you can't even buy a junk used car for $4,200. That's what she's alluding to. That was the man along that I talked about. And I talked about gratitude comes from seeing the bigger picture. We tend to have tunnel vision. We see the picture that we think most relates to us. You know, there's some phenomenal allotments around where I live. And if you plucked my house down in one of those allotments, it would be the smallest thing in there. But I look at my house. It's 2,400 square feet. That is just absolutely plenty for me and my wife. The kids are all grown and gone now. It was even plenty when we had the 10 kids at home. How many people in the world have a house 2,400 square feet? I'm going to tell you, I think it's it's got to be less than a percent. Got to be. But we tend to look at U.S. culture and particular parts of U.S. culture and say, well, I don't have that. Yeah, you don't. But the gratitude goes up when you realize how much you do have compared to the rest of God's people. Feel guilty enough? Dr. Ray.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift from our day sponsor, Pat Schaefer, who would like to wish her son, Michael Schaefer, a happy birthday today. Michael is a blessing in our lives. He's an excellent son and brother and devoted husband and father of three little boys and one little girl. We pray he has a blessed birthday today.
You can be a day sponsor too. Call toll free 1-877-288-1077 and say, I want to be a day sponsor.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jingle.
What does the term discernment of spirits mean? Father Timothy Gallagher writes, discern comes from the Latin discernere, which means to separate things according to their qualities, to distinguish between one thing and another. In this case, to identify one spiritual reality as different from another. Discernment is the process of separating spiritual movements and looking at the origin of each and the thoughts connected to it. Father Gallagher continues, the phrase of spirits describes what is to be discerned, that is, which spiritual realities are to be distinguished, one from the other. The word spirits, as Ignatius uses it in this context, indicates those affective stirrings of the heart, joy, sadness, hope, fear, peace, anxiety, and similar feelings with their related thoughts that influence our life of faith and progress toward God.
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Whistling is a lost art. It is said that Bing Crosby was more proud of his whistling than his singing. If you remember, there's a part in White Christmas, which at one time was the highest selling song of all time. And by the way, Bing Crosby did not take any royalties for his version of Silent Night, and I'm not sure about White Christmas, but definitely not Silent Night, because he thought he didn't want to make money off of singing a song about our Lord. Okay, Dr. A, what is your opinion, that's what it is, it's my opinion, on allowing a 17-year-old to make his own decisions regarding which video games to play? Well, that's easy. No. The fact that he's 17 and living at home, of course. Now, if you weren't living at home, you couldn't do anything about it. But he's living at home. He's still, to some degree, under your parental supervision. And you know what is good for him. Now, if you let him make this decision, are you going to let him make a decision whether he should go to church or not? Are you going to let him make a decision on what foods to eat? I mean, he wants to eat Cheetos, pretty much Cheetos and regular soda. That's what he wants. You going to let him? What about the decision regarding the car? I mean, he wants to use the car. His curfew is 2. What is it about the video games? See, that's my question. What is it about the video games that give you pause? Because I'm sure that these other areas, you have certain standards and you enforce them. So what is it about this? Is it that his level of resistance and resentment would be much stronger if you said no, only certain games? See, that's what I find with older kids pushing on their parents, which is we tend to become a little more wobbly in our standards when their resistance gets stronger, when they push harder. Because the harder they push, one, it takes more courage on our part to stand strong, but two, we have these nagging worries about, well, if we don't relent on something they feel so very, very passionate about, i.e. playing any video game I want to play, what could be the upshot? Resentment? Deception? Hatred? Sneakiness? What will be the upshot? See, the question becomes, we take a stand, what we believe is right or wrong, or what we believe is the best move for our child's well-being. Social, emotional, moral, we make those stands. We're the parents. We've got to do it. The outcome, the child's reaction, could be unknown to us. They could have brewing resentment we know nothing about. The more obvious stuff, the resistance and the arguing and the nagging, okay, that bothers us, but we generally can stand up to it. It's the more subtle psychological stuff. What's brewing inside his head? And how will it manifest itself? You know, the first chance he gets, will he stop going to church? Will he look at me like I'm a religious freako? And all of his parents have no problem with that particular... All of his friends' parents have no problem with that particular video game. Why are you the only one? That's a very common fear of parents, and it keeps so many of them from making the standard that they wish to enforce. It does. They compromise. They wobble. They give in because they're afraid. Afraid. Double underline, afraid of the psychological ramifications that they can't see. This is something that has never been a part of parenting in virtually all of human history. It is directly related to the onslaught of the experts and all of their theories and all of their notions about if you become a parent like you wish to be a parent, you're not abusive, you're not nasty, you're making judgments. Good, loving parents make judgments. But what if you make the wrong one? Then I make the wrong one. I'm not God. I can't know. And even God knows, but he allows us to not listen. He allows us to ignore him. He allows us to defy him. He allows us to make decisions that are going to hurt us. He allows it, even though he knows perfectly well the best thing for us to do. He's told us. But no, we're like the 17-year-old. I'm going to make my own decisions regarding my video games of life. So, all of that is to say, my opinion, you make those decisions, Mom, for your son's well-being. And you can't gauge necessarily how he's going to take it. But you can be calm and confident knowing you did what was good in your eyes. Thank you for joining me so much on this E-Person Monday. Walk with God. The best walk ever.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRRay.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.